friends, and welcome back to the Lingering on the Lectionary podcast, where we reflect on the life of the churches, the local academy, and the rhythm of the church's liturgy. Thanks for being here. In this episode, I talk with Dr. Benjamin Laird about his recent work on the New Testament canon, the formation of the Pauline corpus, and the challenge and reward of doing research on the biblical canon. Thanks for listening. Well, welcome, Ben. I'm glad that you're here with us today to discuss some of your work on the New Testament and canon studies. As we begin here, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do, maybe some of your teaching and research areas?
Be glad to. And yeah, thanks for having me on to discuss canon today. Always fun to discuss these things. But I grew up in a Christian home, fortunate enough to grow up in a Bible-believing family with Christian parents who love the Lord. Grew up in suburbs of Denver, Colorado, kind of between downtown Denver and Boulder, in a suburb called Westminster. And right before ninth grade, my family moves to Virginia to be close to where my mom is from, where she grew up. And so I went to high school here in Virginia. Then I bounced around a number of years and went to different schools and came back to Lynchburg. Wasn't really planning on this, but we moved back to Lynchburg about 10 years ago. And ever since then, I've been teaching at Liberty University, teaching New Testament courses, some Greek courses, that type of thing. So really enjoyed our time. I've had a chance to teach a variety of different programs, different courses. I've had doctoral students, students working on graduate degrees, undergraduate students. So I've seen quite a mix in my time here. But it's just a great place to be, to raise a family and to teach. And speaking of raising a family, we do have five children, so we're blessed by that. So they're our most important students, I guess you could say, here in the family. But that's just a little bit of my background.
Yeah, good. And so you do New Testament, but you also have a special interest in canon studies. I don't think we've ever talked about this. How did you first become interested in this area, like the canon formation? Was it something that was always interesting to you, or was there a particular book or study or person that helped catapult you into this area?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I've always been interested in canon studies, really, because I've always had a love for history. When I was an undergrad student, I did a history degree along with Bible. And so I've just always loved anything historical. I just find to be really interesting. So canon just really seemed to fit. I mean, there's so many puzzle pieces to it, so many subjects that I just find really enthralling, really interesting. So I would say maybe as a grad student, I got interested in the subject of canon. I wasn't, doing any serious research on it, just reading some books, not doing, scholarship. But I was interested in the subject, and it was just kind of a favorite thing for me to read and keep up with. Then when I got to my doctoral years, like a lot of students, you start to ponder, what can I research? And I was kind of thrown between two ideas, to use Paul's language, hard pressed, right? Between two kind of ideas here. And one idea was to do something in Pauline theology. I was kind of thinking about that. And then I was also interested in canon. And so I kind of went back and forth for a while. And then I just happened to be reading some books on canon. And there were several books that came out maybe, 15, 20 years ago on canon that I thought were very helpful, got me thinking about canon formation. And examples would be Nina Hoyce's work on the Catholic Epistles, not by Paul alone, which was his, I think, a revision of his doctoral work at Aberdeen, where I ultimately went to school. So he had a study on the early formation of the Catholic Epistles, and then Chuck Hill from Reformed Seminary, he had published on the Johannine corpus in early Christianity. And then we also have Trobisch, who's written a couple works on canon. One of those was a very slim volume that I found really interesting, and that was called the Paul's, I think something like Paul's Letter Collection. And so that got me thinking about Paul, and I thought, I kind of want to do something. If I can combine Paul and canon, let's put the two together. We don't actually have to choose really one of the two. We can still keep in the world of Paul here, but let's combine Paul and canon and let's do a thorough study on the Pauline corpus and early Christianity. So that's ultimately where I settled. And Trobisch influenced me, I think, a little bit in the early going, but I have some different viewpoints on some issues and wanted to go about my study in a different way, I guess you could say. But, you know, the idea of just analyzing what we know about the early formation of Paul's letters, that was just really a curious, really a point of fascination for me. So I would say those books that came around that time, early 2000s, maybe to 2010, somewhere in that decade, I found really interesting and got me thinking about some of the things that I'm still working on today.
One of the things that I was thinking when you were kind of describing your journey into this interesting area is the thing that's both challenging and rewarding about something like canon studies. This is true of other any of the other disciplines, but something about the biblical canon in particular is that it's by nature interdisciplinary. So the history of early Christianity, or just the some text critical things, or some theological elements. It makes it a fascinating area of study, but also sometimes a little bit difficult as you're trying to think, what could I actually focus on here?
Yeah.
Instead of just trying to say everything at once.
Yeah. I mean, with my doctoral work, I think one of the challenges I faced was my work was very broad. I mean, it doesn't sound broad when I describe it because, you know, we're talking about the formation of Paul's letters, but there's so many things that go into this because you have patristic sources, you have textual witnesses, Greek and Latin and other even versions. You've got canonical list. You've got literary conventions from the first and second century. So all these things go into it, even theology, hermeneutics. So canon is really, as you know very well, it's really at the crossroads of so many disciplines. And so it can be intimidating to get started on the journey because we live in such a segmented society. I think in scholarship especially, it's very, people focus on their little area, right? And their area of expertise. And so you've got folks who are text critics, folks who are church historians, folks who are linguists. I mean, there's the different experts in all these different fields. And so when you start to go down this road, you're a bit intimidated because there's always someone who knows a portion, one of those pieces a little better than you do, right?
Yeah.
And so it requires you to be familiar with a lot of different disciplines, a lot of subject areas. Most of the time, I would say doctoral students kind of just go and focus on one little piece of the puzzle. But what mm-hmm. we're trying to do in canon studies oftentimes is put the pieces together, which is very difficult at times.
Yeah. Well, especially for students thinking about working in an area, the process of narrowing to a manageable topic, but it's this constant process of narrowing and then realizing that what you thought was narrow, once you get in, it's like the TARDIS, it's bigger on the inside. Doing that over and over again, where you think, oh, I want to study canon. Oh, I need to pick the New Testament, and then New Testament studies, Paul, and then Paul, his collection, and then still, even as you get down into the nitty gritty of things, you're still finding these open, these little gateways that lead to all kinds of interesting aspects that, like you said, from the outside might appear like just completely minute or beside the mm-hmm. point. Mm-hmm. But that's part of, if you've made that journey, you recognize, well, some of these little things, these tweaks in the very center of this affect the way that it, the implications of those things, right? So the interconnectedness of this area of study is really interesting.
Yeah, it really is. And I feel like I'm just, maybe you feel this way too, but I feel like I'm just scratching the surface on so many of these things.
Yeah.
I've had a chance to look at a lot of different, pieces of evidence, like a lot of us have, but there's so much more to explore and to consider. And no matter mm-hmm. How much I look into these things, I feel like I could always say more. In fact, that's probably one of the major criticisms that we get when we write on canon. Folks have their level or their subject of expertise. So when they look over the work, they're naturally inclined to say, well, he didn't spend enough time discussing this or that. And any one of these little puzzle pieces could be an entire dissertation, right? That we're looking at, an entire monograph, entire book. But oftentimes we're trying to put together those small pieces the best we can and mm-hmm. come up with a coherent story, I guess, on how this collection came together.
Yeah. Well, that's a good segue to one of the things I wanted to talk about with you today. I was excited about being able to chat. You've recently published several thousand books on the New Testament canon. So today let's start with the one you published this summer called
creating the canon, composition, controversy, and the authority of the New Testament with IVP. So maybe just as a way to kind of get into what you're doing in this book, what would you say are some of the central claims that you make in the book as a whole?
Good. Yeah, I have this book divided into three major units. So we have composition and then formation and then the section on authority at the end, eight chapters. So three chapters, two chapters on those three sections there. And each of those could really be kind of self-contained. There is some relationship between them, but it's almost like I've got three different treatments going on here. So I would say if you look at the first three chapters where I look into composition, I'm really concerned there with, you know, how do these biblical authors go about writing these works? Someone like Paul or someone like Matthew, when he decided to write this, their work, how did they go about this? What was the process? What were the various steps involved? And so I just try to do the best I can to draw on recent scholarship and some of the evidence we have from early Christianity and just the broader Greco-Roman world, what we know about literary practices in that day. And I think one of the things I emphasize is that there were multiple people that were involved in writing. And that's something I try to bring up right away in the book. I think in the first chapter, I discuss the various personalities that would have assisted someone like Paul when he wrote. So Paul's not just writing in isolation away from everyone, like we might want to write today, you know, get away from everyone and just kind of hunker down and crank it out. But Paul is going to be working with a team, and that would have involved, as we know, a scribe. We don't know that all the biblical authors used a scribe. I don't think we have to conclude that, but at least some of them did. And so there's going to be a scribe involved, a letter carrier is going to be involved. You can't just, you know, send this electronically, a work electronically once it's completed. So there's going to be letter carriers, possibly even others in the community that played a role in some way or another. Maybe some of them served as sources of information for what was going on in distant locations. For example, if Paul is writing to a church in Corinth, or maybe he's in Corinth and he's writing to another church, he's going to want to know what's going on in that distant location. That might require him sending a delegate to that place to come back with news, with some kind of report, what's going on there. So that's one of the things I mentioned, just how, and emphasize just how involved this was with a team. It wasn't just Paul's own ministry. And in fact, everything Paul did in ministry was with a team, with associates. So I think letter writing was very similar. Then I also get into the audience a little bit. You know, who are these works written to? And in hermeneutics, we always learn, of course, you know, you take hermeneutics 101 in college or seminary, and one of the first things you learn, and it's an important principle, is that we need to know what the original author intended, right? And not just consider what it means for us, but what was it that prompted the original author to write? And then how would the original readers have understood this? And even more than that, who was the original audience? And what do we know about their circumstances and the things that were facing them? So that's important. But I also think that many of these writings had a broader audience in mind than maybe we realize. And I would include even Paul's letters in that. So I give an example of Romans in the book, and I discuss how it's very possible that the first people to read, sounds like a trick question, but the first people to read Romans would have not been the Romans. It probably would have been the Corinthians. And maybe I could even restate that and say the first people to hear Romans would have been the Corinthians, because it likely would have been read publicly. Probably a better chance of that than, you know, they're going home reading private copies of this. We don't know how many of them had that ability or even had access to those writings at this point. But yeah, I think we have a wider audience. I would say that's true for the Gospels. And I'm not alone in that. Others have argued, you know, Richard Bauckham had an edited volume not too long ago, I think called something like The Gospel for All Christians. He's going to argue that it had a broader audience, and I find that persuasive. And the same would be true for Paul's letters. I think they had a wide audience in mind. And then, of course, we have the Catholic epistles, and been known for a long time, been thought for a long time. They had a very wide audience, too, and weren't just meant for maybe, you know, one particular local congregation. And so that's something I emphasize. What do we know about the audience? And then, as I said, the second major unit, I get into canon formation, and this is probably more of the introductory type section of the book, less of a discussion on kind of current ideas and more of just a an introduction. So if folks are new to the canon and just want to know, okay, what are the major pieces of evidence we have for early canon formation? I have a chapter on that where I just give a very brief survey of the major pieces of evidence. Then I have another chapter, pretty brief, where I just lay out my view of just how the canon came together as a whole, not just, you know, one section, but the whole canon. And what I really emphasize there, it's not my own idea, but thankfully a lot of folks are now starting to be aware of this. And you were involved with a edited volume Darian Lockett took part in recently on the subcollections, I believe. And that's something I emphasize heavily in the book too, is that the New Testament is not a collection of 27 individual books that just kind of came in one at a time, right? But it's a very, it was a very natural process. And I always describe it to my students as a collection of collections. I think that's the best way to think of the canon. It's the Pauline epistles, but also we have the fourfold gospel, we have Acts, Revelation, really the only two books that weren't always part of another collection. Even Catholic epistles was often related to Acts, but Acts and Revelation, and then of course the Catholic epistles, which from what we can tell was a self-contained unit, eventually became a unit at some point, and sometimes even seems to have circulated with Acts. But we have those major kind of foundational pieces to the canon. So to find your way into the canon, to, for a book to make its way into the New Testament canon, it first had to make its way through one of those collections, right? It had to be part of that. So we don't have books like Hebrews making their way just kind of on their own right into the New Testament canon. What we find is that it had to be recognized as a Pauline letter and circulate with the Pauline corpus to be recognized as part of the New Testament canon. So the New Testament is just a collection of smaller collections, is the way I describe it. So I have a chapter on that where I look at the process there of canon formation. And then the last two chapters, I wasn't actually planning on writing them when I got started. I wanted the book originally to be purely historical and to address a number of misperceptions that people have on the canon, or maybe some items that are overlooked, some aspects of canon formation that are often overlooked today. So that was kind of my original intention. That's still mostly what I do. I still have several chapters on that, but I was challenged by the publishers to include, they thought it would be fitting to have a section, maybe in the introduction or maybe a conclusion, to address the theological nature of the canon, to look at the authority of the canon, because there are, I think there were some questions on how does all this relate to inspiration, right? If we just think of the canon as purely a, you know, historical process with everyday human authors, well, how does inspiration fit into that? So they encouraged me to discuss inspiration or authority in some way. And that actually led to two chapters at the end. So I wasn't planning on that. But I kind of rounded off the book talking about, you know, what makes these books authoritative? Because I find that when I quiz students on this, sometimes it takes them a minute to kind of get their mind around it and to think about the question. But I find that the answers kind of go a lot of different directions. And a lot of times they haven't thought about this, or if they have thought about it, I would say maybe they need to consider some other factors as well. But I've just been surprised just how diverse the responses have been when you question people about what makes this work authoritative. And then you can even press them. If their answer sounds reasonable, you might question them a little bit. And then you find that they're a little shaky on how they got to that conclusion. So so I just thought it might be helpful to address that issue. And as you know, I discuss the subject of apostolic authorship quite a bit in those last few chapters. Not that I'm the first one to emphasize that at all. It goes all the way back to the early church, of course. But I felt like that was a key piece of the puzzle that doesn't always get proper attention or emphasis. So we rounded out the book then with apostolic authorship. And I emphasized that that's important historically and theologically. Historically, it was a key criterion in the early church. They were naturally drawn towards the works that were apostolic, that could be traced back to the original apostolic community. But I also find that there's some viewpoints on the apostolic community that the early church had that maybe we don't hold today. So I had to kind of work through that issue. What do we mean by apostolic? You know, terms like that are used so many different ways. And I find that the early church would argue that something's apostolic and maybe we wouldn't today.
And then there's things we might call apostolic today that the early church would not. Mm-hmm. So I find that there was a bit of a discrepancy there. So that's anyway what I looked into in the last couple chapters. So I wish I had an entire book for every one of these chapters, but I had to kind of go over each one of those just in a very cursory way on that. So
that's a great rundown of the content of the book, but also the structure of the book, kind of this bird's eye view of things. One of my favorite things about this particular book is kind of what you've been alluding to, the three major sections here. Because you are overviewing and summarizing some of these issues, like as you mentioned, could all be monographs in their own right. But by doing that and bringing those all these chapters together, it kind of makes a cumulative case that these all three of these areas, while they are unwieldy in some ways, are necessary for us to understand just the basic question of what is the New Testament. So these sections of your book really kind of implicitly make that case that all three of these areas are important. In particular, the way that you described in the study of the New Testament, sometimes what you get most in the New Testament canon, what you get most is a focus on historical issues, especially today in the guild, like the social context or the reception history in the third or fourth century discussions and disputes. But the structure of your book, you address some of those things, particularly in the middle section, but you begin with that exploration of the composition of these texts and then end with that lingering discussion about the issue of authority. So maybe let's maybe just kind of reflect a little more on why do you think it's important in terms of even historically to include both the idea of composition but also the idea of authority when we are discussing canon formation?
Yeah, very good. Well, it's a whole process, right? And so when people discuss inspiration, they would often refer to what they call the original autographs, right? Well, that's the end of the compositional process. But I'm curious how we get to that point, because that leads to a lot of questions then. If these works are inspired, which I hold that they were inspired, how did that information come to these authors? Should we assume that if a work is inspired, then the process was somehow different? Because in a lot of religious traditions, that is the assumption. Like in Mormonism, there is an assumption, right, that like the tablets just kind of come out of heaven and they end up in the woods in, I guess, New York or something, right? So we don't have a normal process by which these works were written, where Joseph Smith is, you know, camped out, you know, thinking about how to phrase this or phrase that or which sources he might use. It's just from God and there it is. And he just simply is a custodian of it. So I just have always been intrigued then, if we are to assume inspiration, does that mean that we are to preclude some kind of human process? And I don't think that we should. And I think that's actually consistent with what the church has believed. Even if we haven't thought too much about, I would say, composition as a process, but we do recognize when we read these texts, we can see that there is a human style, right? There's a Pauline style, there's a Johannine style, there's a Luke Acts style, you know, we can discern that. We can see the personalities of the human authors, and that's something that's been affirmed. We can look at the Chicago Statement, for example, and it's very clear in that statement that inspiration does not preclude the human authors, you know, the touch of the human authors on this. And I would say that would also be the case with the process that led to canon formation. So there is a tie, if you will, between inspiration and composition, because there's just a lot of questions that arise when we think about inspiration. And I happen to think we can combine the two. We want to know what happened historically, but we also want to realize these are divinely inspired writings. And the analogy I like to give to my students is when we study Christology, you know, we're going to get into trouble if we emphasize Christ's humanity, but we overlook his divinity, or we emphasize his divine status, and by trying to protect his divine status, we try to distance his humanity in some way. Then we get into, you know, Docetism or Arianism or one of those kind of things in the early church. And I would say it's the same with the New Testament writings. We want to understand that these are theological documents. They're divine in their origin. God has preserved them for us. So there's clearly a theological dimension to this, a spiritual side of things, but they're also human documents as well. And so the more I think we can learn about how writings circulated, how they were composed, I think the better equipped, the more informed we'll be on discerning how the New Testament writings were also composed as well. So I think there's a connection. Some have questioned the progression of the chapters. I had one person say, well, why didn't you start with the question of authority? Well, one issue is it wasn't originally part of my plan. So that's kind of the practical right. side of it. I had the other five chapters or six chapters in mind first. And so it was only at the end of the process I decided to add those two chapters on apostolic authority and some of those theological issues. But also I think there's a natural progression because we're starting with composition and then composition leads to formation. Formation is subsequent to that, right? And then now we have these writings in their preserved form. And now the question is, the practical question is, well, what relevance are they to us today? Are these just classic Christian works? What's the basis of their authority for believers today? So I think there's kind of a chronological, natural chronological sequence to this. And so I ended up with the question of, you know, what's the basis of the authority today then for believers?
Yeah, and some of both of those ideas of how the text came to be and also how they were received as authoritative, even when we're speaking about letters, both of those issues are right there on the surface of New Testament texts. So like reading reading Romans and then coming across, you know, oh, Paul wrote Romans, and then reading a text and the end of Romans say, I, Tertius, wrote this letter. Like, well, hold on, wait, what's going on here? You know, so some of those historical context of like, this is the way that all letters were written in this way, so it would make sense here. But then also you have in the New Testament, of course, examples of, you know, Second Peter referring to Paul's letters and then associating them with authoritative scripture. So there, another example of like the issue of authority and then also the issue of the complex nature of composition. They're right there on as if we're saying closely read these New Testament texts, these are some of the questions that will arise for someone who is even a casual reader who's taking a close look at these texts. And one of the things I thought was interesting, you mentioned students and asking follow-up questions. I've often found, as you just kind of alluded to earlier, sometimes a criticism or a statement or a position is put forth relatively strongly, and then all that's needed to kind of push into like the fuller understanding of that person or that student is just ask a simple follow-up question.
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean by this? And it's like, well, I'm not sure. A lot
or
of
how would you explain X, Y, or Z, right? How do you explain that? And you find they often haven't thought through all of that before.
Yeah. And so a lot of the chapters in your book kind of start with that initial idea and then kind of show where some of the nuance and some of that broader framework is. And one of the things I thought, you do focus on authority and apostolic authorship in the end, but that's also a historical question because you're having to think, well, what do we mean by authority typically when we say it today? What did the earliest churches think of authority and what did they connect that to as the New Testament was forming? So there's in theological discussions today, there's an emphasis on retrieval and kind of recovering some classic positions. And I've thought about that in terms of some of the work that is needed or that's happening today in something like canon studies is sometimes recovering previous generations of scholarship where some of what they're doing, of course, needs to be modified in light of new evidence or just paradigm shifts, but it's also kind of recovering some of the core of what their positions was. So maybe even just Theodore Zahn's work on the New Testament with the emphasis on the way that the New Testament was used in the usage and that being connected to authority. If that's completely neglected, it might lead to a different kind of distortion. So kind of recovering some of these older scholarly positions with the modification of, you know, recent research. And so some of the, even the historical questions are oftentimes explicitly theological, and then some of the theological questions also connect directly to textual issues and also historical issues. So it kind of illustrates, even in the nitty-gritty of some of these areas, that enduring interconnectedness of the study of the canon.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of these questions that we might be just thinking of now that we think are all that are very novel, I think that folks in previous generations actually did look at them a bit more than we realized, right? People like Harnack and Zahn, a lot of these people did look into these things, and oftentimes they're a bit forgotten except for specialists today. But a lot of the thing, the historical questions they looked into are starting to resurface. Maybe we're connecting the dots a little differently, but and so we have some new witnesses now, but we're starting to ask some of those same questions that were posed back then. And so it's an exciting time, I would say, in canon studies. And and often, like you said earlier in our discussion, one kind of question that you look into will lead into something else. But Zahn was interested in, you know, the early worship of the church and, you know, the use of scripture in gatherings and things like that. And I'm interested in that, too. It's fascinating to think about these writings, the Pauline letters and the fourfold gospels being used in early communities. That's interesting. But I think it's also important to go beyond just, you know, what churches were using this at this time. You know, if, you know, putting out a grid and, you know, we have these 24 books that, you can imagine that kind of thing. These 24 books were, you know, used by these people and used in this quarter. And that's helpful. It gives us, I guess, a bird's eye view of the use of scripture at different times and places. But I'm also interested in why they were reading these books. And so there is a theological element to this, and it's historical too. But the question of why, I'm not sure, has been asked enough. What was it that drew people to these writings in the first place? And that's one of the things I get into at the end of the book. And I try to make the point that they weren't just like Christian classics. I remember, you know, going to 12th grade English class, and you would get a book and you just kind of wonder, why do we have to read this? And there's one time I actually asked the professor or the teacher, you know, why do we need to read this book? I'm not so sure why. And she said, well, it's a classic. It's a classic, so you need to just know it because it's a classic. And I just thought, well, who made it a classic? If I don't like reading it and I'm not benefiting from this book, then why do we need to call it a classic? You know, who came up with this kind of thing? And you know, sometimes I think we have this kind of concept of early Christian writings that we have all these, you know, dozens of writings that were produced, and we still have many of them today. But, you know, what set these 27 apart? Was it just some kind of political wrangling going on in the early church? Was it the fact that they're superior in a certain way? Do they have some type of quality or attributes that the other writings don't have? So, yeah, I'm interested in the development of the canon, but I'm also interested in why, as I said. What separates these books from the others?
Yeah, and you mentioned the kind of the caricature, or not the caricature, but the rightful critique of a previous generation of scholarship, where they thought about canon only in the terms of reception history, which it's kind of like what I think of as like an Excel sheet, a spreadsheet way of thinking about canonical reception, where Irenaeus mentions this writing, so it goes in this column, and then you do that for the entire corpus, and then you look and say, okay, this is their canon. And it's like, well, I think that method has been rightly critiqued, but sometimes thrown out of that is like what you're mentioning is like, what's in my opinion, what's more interesting is what you were just describing of like, not just that Irenaeus or Origen or Athanasius uses this particular writing, but like the way that they're using it, and how is that similar or dissimilar than the way they're using, you know, the Shepherd of Hermas or any other type of Christian writing of the time. This kind of leads into kind of one of the broader things that you're doing in your book of a lot of times that when we talk about the development or progression of the study of the New Testament canon or canon studies in general, what sometimes drives that forward is not a new piece of evidence, but a new way of looking at the evidence that we already have. So when we tell the story of canon formation, we're forced to work with a rather limited set of evidence. And many times the thing that reshuffles the way we think of canon formation comes from a place we might not expect, like literacy rates in the ancient world, or the way people wrote personal or private letters, or public letters, or the way that publishers actually worked. So you mentioned several of these at various points in your publications in this book. So what do you think are some of the more interesting examples of recent research that gives us perhaps a more clear glimpse into the process of canon formation or the production and circulation of the New Testament writings? We've already talked about a few of them, but what's a good example of something that has been recently worked out or established that kind of helps us kind of rethink the way that we've reconstructed the story of canon formation?
Yeah, good question there. I would say I could probably answer that multiple ways. One would be there's this assumption, especially among, I would say, lay readers, especially, that the councils were very determinative and helped shaped everything. And so there were some kind of political, maybe some kind of extrinsic circumstance that forced the church to, you know, form a canon or something like that. So I think a bit more of attention to the church history of the 4th and 5th century has been helpful. I think it's helped dispel that quite a bit. So that doesn't help us figure out what did happen, but that's helpful for giving us clarity as to what maybe was not the best way to look at it. So I would say that's one thing. And then as far as just composition goes, I think we know a little bit more today on early writing technology. So things like codices, the use of the codex, is helpful. We find some interesting things there. We found some interesting things about scribes and how they often functioned, or maybe I could use a word like secretary or amanuensis. So we're learning more about them, really, because we've discovered so many just everyday letters from the Greco-Roman world over the last 120, 130 years. And so that gives us a better sense of the role that they played. And that's, as we talked about earlier, that is actually instrumental, I believe, in understanding how some of these letters came together, especially Paul's writings. I think he used a secretary. So we're learning more about the function of secretaries, even letter carriers. We know more about them than, you know, several, maybe even a century ago. And then, of course, we have a broader range of witnesses that are starting to get attention. So a lot of the New Testament papyri have been discovered over the last century, especially since the 1940s. So that's helped us quite a bit. And additional research into the church fathers as well. We're starting to look at maybe some writings of the church fathers that haven't always drawn attention, maybe broader in scope. We've been looking more broadly at, I think, it's some of the patristic sources. And then to go back to what we talked about a few minutes ago, just the idea of subcollections has really, I think, in the last 5 years especially, there's been much more written on that. And so there's mm-hmm. the Glennie and Lockett volume that discusses the rise of the subcorpora. And I think that's helpful. And I've addressed that as well. And we've had a number of monographs that have addressed maybe one part of the New Testament. So I gave a few examples of that earlier, like David Nienhuis and Darian Lockett discussing the Catholic epistles. And we have people like Charles Hill discussing the Johannine letters, and several that have addressed Charles Hill and Peter Williams addressing the Gospels, and you know, people like Simon Gathercole addressing the early history of the Gospels. And I've been looking at the Pauline epistles and David Trobisch as well. So we're starting to, I think, shed more light on the individual components of the canon. And that's, I think, giving us a little better perspective on how these came together. But I would say there's a lot of material evidence that has been analyzed a bit more in the last several years, and that's been helpful. But also just with regard to composition and the process, we're learning much more about just the literary world of the first century, and that's been really interesting. And I feel like that's where there's so much more research to be done there.
Right. Yeah. And I think like the one that you mentioned, the interesting way that the concept of subcollections helps us understand like the broader coming together of the New Testament. And I think that has a lot of explanatory power for students and just interested people in the church as they're thinking of reshifting or flipping the mindset of how we think of books being in or out of the canon, seeing that books don't, quote, enter the canon as little individuals, but as part of associated collection, smaller collections. So I think that helps, like when we're thinking of how did Obadiah make it into the Old Testament alongside of Isaiah? But it's a little easier to think of Obadiah as part of the Book of the 12 and then being associated with Isaiah or Philemon. How could Philemon compete against Romans? But as part of a collection, it's just a totally different way of thinking about how how the Bible is coming together.
Yeah, and that goes back to what we said about codices, right? So when we look at the Greek witnesses that we have, it's actually very rare that we see New Testaments in circulation. Very, very rare. And and the ones that we do have are very famous, and they're at museums somewhere, and you can't touch them, right? Like Sinaiticus or something like that. So the vast majority of the manuscripts tended to just have maybe one collection, like the Pauline letters, or the most commonly circulated one was the fourfold gospel. So most of the time when people before, this is just hard for people to get their minds around, but before the printing press, I mean, we're talking about just a little before the Protestant Reformation, but up until that point, we're talking about 1500 years of church history. When people encountered scripture in written form, it wasn't usually an entire Bible or even an entire New Testament. It was usually a small portion. So the challenge for us is we're looking backwards, and in our mind, we think of a Bible. And so we wonder how the Bible came together. But that's not really a question that I think was all that common in the first 1500 years, because they're just used to smaller sections. Mm-hmm. And they would think of, like a Jewish reader might think of the law, the prophets, and the writings. The early Christians, and even all the way up through, as I said, the printing press, they would have thought in terms of the Gospels and Paul's letters. Mm-hmm. And so you have the works of the apostles, you have Acts, you have the Gospel writing. So they would tend to think in terms of these smaller units much more than we have. And so just going back and looking at those witnesses, I think, has proven to be very, very important and very helpful.
Well, that's a good segue to kind of, we can just briefly mention the book you just published recently as well, on the Pauline corpus in early Christianity, its formation, publication, and circulation. And this was, if I understand correctly, this was a revision of your doctoral thesis.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, revision and expansion. It got pretty long after I was able to get back to it.
Yeah. Well, to put it mildly, books, articles, sermons, and studies of the Apostle Paul and his theology are numerous, to say the least. But you note in this book that there's not nearly as much study on the collection of Paul's letters and how it came to be. So just briefly, like, why do you think that this is? And what would you say are some of the unique or challenging aspects of studying Paul's letters?
Yeah, well, the challenge is probably just simply complexity. So I'll just throw the word complexity out there, but get back to some of your other questions there. Yeah, there hasn't been a whole lot written on the early formation of Paul's letters. There's been a whole lot written on Paul, just dozens and dozens of works. And every year there's new works coming out, and I'm guilty of that too. But a lot of works on Paul, but there hasn't been much on how Paul's letters came together, which I was really surprised. And when I started to look into this as a new doctoral student, looking into, you know, what am I going to research here and where am I going to go with this work? I found there's really just two major kind of works, I guess you could say. One was an older work in the 1950s by C. Leslie Mitten was his name. And what he did was he just simply kind of echoed some of the early views of what we might call the Chicago School, like people like Goodspeed and John Knox. And it just kind of took that and ran with it. And I wasn't convinced at all by the viewpoints of Mitten. I found it really interesting what he had to say. But the book was very slim and very out of date. And I thought, you know, this we could actually treat this and go a very different direction than Mitten ever did. Mm-hmm. And then recently we have the work of Trobisch. And I found more agreement with Trobisch, but it's still not a entirely comprehensive work at all. Right. It's very slim and it's helpful. It's very interesting. It's engaging in so many ways, but I felt like a fuller study was warranted, especially because we've had larger studies, as I said, on other areas of the New Testament, like the Catholic epistles and especially the Gospels. So I felt like the time was right, but it's a very difficult subject, I would say, because it's so complex. And I would say that's probably, I'm just guessing, that that may be a main reason why many are a bit intimidated by this. A lot of Pauline scholars are much more interested in controversial issues that relate to his theology, right? Things like the new perspective, or, you know, is Paul, how apocalyptic was he as a thinker, or was he anti-imperial in his life? Things like that. They're much more interested in content and not as much concerned about the background. But then also you have, I would say, the subject of pseudepigraphy, which makes it kind of challenging.
Right.
Because you've got two issues here. You've got, what does the early church say about this? And the early church seems to have no qualms whatsoever with accepting works like Ephesians and 2 Thessalonians. And many of them are even recognizing Hebrews and the pastorals as Pauline without any hesitation. But today, many scholars just outright reject about half of these writings as authentic. And so it's almost like you have to discount everything the early church said, or a lot of what the early church said, and try to come up with a theory on canon formation that fits with the sensibilities of modern scholarship. Right. That can be very, very challenging. And I just tried to go at this by looking at the sources and just letting the kind of the conclusions go where they might and where they may, and not worry too much about, you know, what do modern scholars say about, you know, the authenticity of 2 Thessalonians or something. But, you know, what do the earliest sources say? That was really a key concern of mine. So I would just say complexity, because, as we said before, you know, what's true of the canon as a whole is very true for Paul as well. When we think more specifically here, you've got theological issues, you've got a host of historical issues all that need to be addressed. And so that just makes it a very difficult task. And no matter what conclusion you make, there's going to be someone who disagrees with you. So,
oh yeah.
So that's another challenge with it.
Well, I remember being, you know, as a youth, starting seminary, doing my first exegetical paper on Colossians, and then going to the library and looking for the shelf for Colossians, and realizing that in the stacks that I was in, an entire shelf and a half was Paul. And so you know, the Gospels got like half a stack, and then there's Paul, a whole wall of Paul. But when thinking about canon formation, a lot of the modern scholarship, as you mentioned, if they're talking about canon formation, it's really about the pseudepigraphy debate. And so moving down to the collection of letters in this particular way, you have to kind of find a different angle to get at it. One of my favorite things about your book here, this monograph on Paul's letters, is one, I think it's very clear. You write very clearly, and you kind of lay out all the different types of evidence, not just internal evidence, but external evidence, and just the way that a good theory of how Paul's letters came together needs to not only focus on one of those, but to at the very least, try to account for all those different types of evidence. So in some ways, one of the things that makes it difficult is what you've demonstrated here is you're making the argument that all of these types of evidence need to be taken into account. So that's just a difficult task as well. I think you successfully make that case, and then also you kind of give a window into what that evidence is.
I think the challenge is you want to come up with a hypothesis that just accounts for the evidence. You don't have any witness that just spells everything out and just tells us everything we want to know and just, you know, it's a slam dunk case now. We don't have that. And I would say even if we had a witness like that, it would still be challenged.
Right, you'd have to contextualize that.
Yeah, I mean, just to give you an example, think about the origin of the Septuagint, right? We've got certain witnesses to how that came about during the Ptolemaic period. And you've got, you know, Justin Martyr, second century, he's telling us about this, and a previous Jewish writing, Letter of Aristeus. It's giving us this very, how do I put it? We would call legendary today about how the Septuagint formed, where you have these 70 men who they all go in their own tents and they work in isolation. And they come together and, you know, lo and behold, their translations were identical word for word with no, you know, interaction at all during that period.
And so scholars look at that and they would say, well, you know, there's no way that that actually happened that way. It's implausible, you know, from a historical standpoint. And so even if we had an account from the late first century or second century just spelling out how Paul's letters were written and how these letters formed, I don't know that that would even settle the debate. So not only are we dealing with that issue, but we just don't have a lot of evidence from the first and second century. It's very sparse. And so what we have to do is just reach a hypothesis that we believe just really fits. And we can't prove anything, but it seems to be right. plausible because it seems to best account for the various pieces that we do have.
Right. Yeah, I really appreciate that about the work as a whole, is because you are careful to try to fit the argument to the available evidence and the nature of the available evidence. So it makes the claim more modest, but much more defensible in that sense of you could kind of have qualms with different parts of your reconstruction, but because you're tying it to a whole body of evidence, that it allows you to kind of think through the different components of how Paul's letters came to be in a way that also accounts for kind of what we actually have and what we actually know about how letters were composed and how they were collected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Two of my favorite things about your proposal is one, the idea that I think would be helpful for a lot of people to think through is the idea of the idea that authors kept copies of their letters. So I think that helps with the idea of like, how did these letters get collected or how did they come to be? The idea that the initial collections of these of Paul's letters could have involved him personally or some of his team as coworkers that are working there. That seems to be a little bit easier of a picture to understand than someone like kind of traveling around the Roman Empire trying to go on an Indiana Jones style quest for Paul's letters. It just seems to have happened too quickly for that to actually have happened. So I thought that was an interesting, the way that you present it is a helpful reminder of an idea that's been around, but recently has kind of gained a little bit of traction in some scholarship, is the idea that Paul could have been involved in some of the initial collecting of his letters, but that makes more sense when you recognize the practice of the time that was possible that authors collect or keep copies of the letters that they send.
Yeah, and that's just one of those things where we've benefited from our study of other literature, you know, outside the New Testament. We've been able to see, you know, people like Cicero, and we see the evidence that they made collections of these letters too, and that formed early collections as well. So that's been really interesting. But yeah, I think it makes much more sense than say the viewpoint of many scholars, even until last generation, really last 30, 40 years. It was just commonly thought that you know, somebody's running around looking for these letters all over. And that was the view of Mitten that I mentioned, you know, back in the 1950s. He had this idea that Luke Acts comes out in the late first century. That's when he dated these writings. And he believed that when people started to read Acts, all of a sudden they become very interested in Paul. And then they go and search for these letters that had been just overlooked for all this time. And that kind of sparked a circulation of the letters. But what I think is more likely is that the letters were very popular from the very time they were written. In fact, I argue that this is probably the first collection of scripture we have is the Pauline letters. I actually think the collection would have emerged before the fourfold gospel. I think you can make a case for that. Many would disagree with me and say the fourfold gospel was first, but I think you can make a case for Paul's letters being first. And I mean, that just speaks to the popularity of Paul, the recognition of his apostolic office and authority. And so they naturally gravitated, as I explained in the other book, well, this one too, just how they just naturally gravitated towards apostolic instruction, just like the early church did in Jerusalem. That was something that continued on. So, yeah, I think that the idea that Paul would have had letters in his possession, I'm thankful that that's receiving a lot more attention now. Trobisch put a lot of attention on that, and I do as well. And I think that's just a more natural way to describe it. And sometimes the most natural way is
is probably the, you know, the a natural argument is probably the most plausible one instead of something more complex.
Mm-hmm. What would you say is kind of just thinking summatively or collectively about the Pauline collection in your work here? Like, what would you say is one of your favorite insights or something you think is most significant that came out of your work on Paul's letters? It may have been something we've already talked about or something, something different. What do you think?
I would say early church perspectives on authorship, the authorship of the specific writings, are very different than they are today. Because today, of course, we have seven writings that are rarely disputed, but we've got seven others that are that were involved with the Pauline letter corpus associated with that. So you have works like 2 Thessalonians and Colossians and Ephesians that, you know, there's still debate about it, significant debate about it, but many are hesitant to recognize their authenticity. And then you've got the pastoral epistles, and very many scholars, I don't know about a percentage, but a large number of them would just outright deny that they were authentic and view them as, you know, something post Paul, and maybe a follower of Paul, or maybe even a subsequent generation. And then Hebrews, virtually no one thinks had any connection to Paul at all. And what I find in the early church is that they were much more supportive of the authenticity of these writings. We don't get any hint in the early church that they, as I said a few moments ago, that they rejected 2 Thessalonians or Colossians or Ephesians, and even the pastorals. We find a few possible witnesses that might suggest that collections circulated without the pastorals, but we don't find anyone just outright rejecting them. So these were widely recognized as authentic in the early church, and even Hebrews was widely thought to be Pauline, or at least associated with someone in the Pauline circle. Mm-hmm. At least we could do that, agree with that. So the idea of authorship, that was something, the concepts of authorship in the early church, convictions of that. I think I was a little surprised just how uniform the church was on that. Also interesting was the personal involvement, as we just talked about. That just helped me understand maybe a little more of the process that likely took place. So that was part of it. I came to the conclusion that the collection probably emerged a little earlier than maybe others realize, or maybe others are willing to concede. Mm-hmm. And when I first started my journey into Paul's letters, I was thinking maybe late first century, early second century, maybe second half of the first half of the second century possibly is when maybe this collection emerged. But I actually think it was first century now. Just based on the early use of these writings and First Clement and, you know, Second Peter, things like that. So earlier than I thought. What else? I think it's interesting how we have these different forms of the edition. And this is kind of the thorny issue that's more complex. But one of the things I note in my investigation is that we actually have some witnesses indicate that we have 10 letters. So that would include the letters to the seven churches. But we also have multiple witnesses. In fact, most of the witnesses included 14 writings. You have some that maybe might have had 13, but 14 letters was very, very common. So kind of goes back to what I said about authorship. But that was very, very common, because a lot of times we have this idea that it wasn't until maybe the 4th or 5th or 6th century that Hebrews kind of found its way into the canon. And what I found was actually the opposite, that early on, there seems to have been widespread support for Hebrews, but that began to actually erode in certain places during the second, third, late second century, especially third, mm-hmm. fourth century. And then it kind of had a revival and everything was kind of okay again by the fourth century. So Hebrews was kind of an interesting piece to the puzzle. And anytime you look into how Paul's letters came together and study this from a historical standpoint, you can't leave Hebrews to the side. You have to discuss this, because it circulated exclusively, of course, as part of the Pauline letter corpus. So you have to figure out how that got in. And that's another just interesting element to this as well.
Yeah, lots of not loose ends, but possible directions that are prompted by your study here. You mentioned, and I got to be careful with our time here, because You mentioned it was in one of your books where you talked about students kind of get wise to the fact that if they want to avoid talking about an exam or something like that, they'll just ask you a question about canon, you know, and then it's like, okay, well, sure, I'll talk about canon some more. I'd like to talk for hours about this, but I know no one will listen to this if we do.
Part three.
Yeah. I like to conclude these conversations with a more general reflective question. Just kind of get your thoughts on, there's a lot going on in our world that is discouraging, but what is something that you've experienced or reflected upon recently that gives you hope?
Well, maybe I could bring up my students once again. I mentioned them earlier in our talk, and I mentioned some of the ways that they may think of canon, some of the common theories that are out there. But, you know, I get a chance to spend a lot of time with students in the classroom, and I would just say I'm very encouraged by their hunger for scripture. When we watch the news, we of course read about things and hear about things every day that are very troubling, very problematic, and very concerning in our world. If we're not careful, we can be very discouraged, as you said. I think even when we think about the overall state of Christianity, it's very easy for us to just think in terms of numbers. And we think about the number of Bible colleges shutting down, or the number of churches mm-hmm. shutting their doors, or the number of baptisms in decline, or the number of members in, you know, this denomination shrinking. And we can be very discouraged. It seems as though Bible-believing Christianity is starting to shrink and lose influence in society. We could easily look down the road and be very discouraged and think that this is just going the wrong direction. And I'm not a prophet. I don't know how numbers will go in the future and how many churches will be founded and planted, things like that. But I do think that God has his remnant. And when I look at the younger generation, the 18, 19, 21, 22-year-olds, I see that there are many of them who have a lot of strong questions and a deep thirst to know God, to know Scripture, to serve the church. And, you know, I'm just happy to know that remnant's going to continue. And that's the promise we have in Scripture, right? I don't think we have a lot of, especially in the New Testament, we don't have, you know, promises that everything is going to just continue to improve. We do read, especially in the pastorals, to go back to Paul, that there's going to be some dark days ahead. And we go elsewhere in the New Testament too, but we know there's going to be a lot of dark days ahead, and the Christian message is not going to be popular, and there's going to be a decline in society in many ways. So I think we can expect that, but I don't think that the whole thing is going to collapse, right? The Christian faith. As I look at not only the promises of Scripture, and then I observe the students, I'm confident that God has his remnant, and that the next generation is going to rise up and be a faithful witness. And I want more soldiers in that army, but I'm happy that we have some good soldiers coming up, and they're going to be willing to defend their faith. I think the challenge is many of my students, and probably the same for you, they come into their undergrad years with a little less knowledge of Scripture than maybe mm-hmm. we did. You know, I grew up in a Christian home, and when I went to college, I knew the Bible pretty well. I hadn't studied it from an academic standpoint, you know, by the time I was 18, but I knew the Bible stories. I knew the content. I could tell you the basic themes of each book by the time I went to college. And I don't think that as many students can do that these days, but I think they want to. And I think that's the important thing is they're thirsty. Many of them are thirsty, and many of them have tried the things of the world. They found it unsatisfactory, and they want something that's of lasting significance. And I think they're looking for that. And I'm glad that they're thirsty for that. And just pleased to see that with my students. So we've got a great opportunity then as educators, I would say, to train up the young generation, because I think we have great, great opportunities.
Yeah, that's a good word to end our discussion of canon formation, to remember that the word is still doing its work in the world and among the churches and believers. That's good.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks, Ben, for joining us today. I appreciate your work on the New Testament canon. I'd love to talk to you about it, and learned a lot from your work. So, and thanks for taking the time to chat with us today.
Absolutely. And thanks so much for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad that you're here with me, here at the end of this episode. If you're still listening, you might be interested in three ways you can support me and the podcast. The first is what you've already done. Listen to this podcast. This year, I'm also writing a weekly newsletter on the canonical approach to biblical studies. So if you're interested in this, you can follow along at chedspellman.substack.com. The second way would be to read, rate, or review any of my books on amazon.com or Goodreads. These are always welcome and are very helpful. My most recent book is An Introduction to the Life and Writings of Irenaeus, an important theologian in the early church. There's a link in the show notes if you're interested. Finally, if you're so inclined, you can buy me a coffee, which is essentially a digital tip jar. Any of these tips go to offset the cost of producing this podcast. You can find a link to this option in the episode description as well. At any rate, Deo Valente, and if the creek don't rise, I'll see you next time. Grace and peace.